We're looking at what sets whistleblowers apart. It is an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are more and more incidents of insiders who speak out trying to stop wrongdoing and fraud in their organization. Last year, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's whistleblower office, it received more than 5,200 whistleblower reports from people across the country in 72 foreign countries. So where have you seen whistleblowers make really meaningful strides for democracy? What place do whistleblowers have in our democracy? Do you see whistleblowing as an apolitical act? We're at 800-642-1234. Tom Mueller is a journalist who reports on fraud and corruption. His new book is called Crisis of Conscience: Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud, and he joins us from New York. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
Well, we'll talk later, to be sure, about the House impeachment inquiry and the whistleblower at the heart of that. But first, help us understand the evolution of the whistleblower since the 1500s. To whistle and to blow had meant to reveal secret information. How have you seen that term change through time?
It's always been a sort of a double-edged sword. The person who reveals wrongdoing is turned on by the wrongdoers and accused of being a traitor or a spy or a snitch, which is an ironic sort of Orwellian inversion. But in the 60s, it began to take real gravitas, real importance with things like films like Silkwood and Serpico, which are, of course, based on real-life dramas of whistleblowers. And Daniel Ellsberg, of course, and then Deep Throat, which, you know, we only learned that it was an FBI senior official, Mark Felt, recently. But a whistleblower brought down Nixon or helped to bring him down. So at that point in the 70s, the American public began to realize how critical whistleblowers are for our democracy. And since then, there's been an explosion of laws both against fraud in the corporate sphere and wrongdoing in the government sphere that are intended to protect whistleblowers. So, you know, their legal status and their social status has been on a steady increase over the last 50 years.
But in your vantage point today, are whistleblowers viewed as heroes, or are they tried to be kept down in some respects?
Well, it really depends on where you stand. The whistleblower and his or her in-group, let's say, the group of people in their organization on whom they blow the whistle, quite often have very different views of this. And the whistleblower, ironically, thinks almost invariably, in my experience, and I've interviewed over 200 whistleblowers in all walks of life, they invariably say, I am looking after the organization. They invariably take their concerns internally first. They don't go to the New York Times. They don't go to the press. And only after they've been squelched internally do they look further to try to stop the problem. And they really speak of a higher loyalty, a higher authority that they're obeying, not their boss, not their CEO, but society. On the other hand, of course, the group on whom they are blowing the whistle is viscerally, violently against their behavior. And you know, some of the extreme emotions that I've seen in my research, where people are ritually humiliated, way over the top, attacks on their psychiatric well-being, you know, being sent for psychiatric fitness for duty examination, put under surveillance to destabilize them. You can tell that there are deep, deep human emotions going on here, way, way deeper than one would expect from a workplace disagreement. And I think it really comes down to a kind of, you know, really evolutionary biological and evolutionary psychological forces that are coming into play here.
We're talking with Tom Mueller. He's a journalist whose new book is Crisis of Conscience: Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Where have you seen whistleblowers make strides for democracy? What place do whistleblowers have today? And what do you think motivates whistleblowers in the realm of the private sector, in government, in military? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Tom, you warn not to typecast whistleblowers, not to think that what they look like or what we see on the big screen in the movie theater. But as you talk with hundreds of them, there are some clear similarities in their personalities, how they speak slowly and carefully, their memory for detail, phenomenal. What are some things that you can take away, some traits that you can take away from these whistleblowers?
Yes, I think it is true that it's a mistake to typecast whistleblowers as either heroes or villains, you know, saints or sinners. If you attempt to make every whistleblower into a Mother Teresa, and then you discover some slight flaw, the tendency is to reject the whole story. Really, what we need to focus on is not their personality, but the facts they bring forward. Having said that, in my experience of over 200 interviews with whistleblowers, several traits, really bedrock traits, come out. One is a certain rigidity in the way they view right and wrong. There are black and white areas, no gray. They aren't susceptible to rationalization or cutting corners. Several people have said, I'm a rules girl. I'm a rules kind of girl. Or I like things very clear. And that causes them to react when they run into bad behavior and not say, well, everybody's doing it, or if I didn't do it, someone else would, or this is part of the mission. They also are able to identify themselves with the ultimate victims. If they're working in a hospital, they don't just see numbers on a spreadsheet. They don't just see income. They see people who are getting unnecessary surgery and what that would be like. I've had several say, well, how would you feel? What if that was your mother? What if that was your brother? And that kind of deep emotive link with the actual victims triggers their behavior. They're also, they're very independent people. Some of them are pretty prickly. They're not the typical go-along-to-get-along team player. And, I was thinking of subtitling my book in Praise of Difficult People, because it really, we need more questioners. We need more people who challenge authority and say, no, I'm not good with that, boss. This is wrong. This is illegal. There are too many good soldiers out there and not enough questioners. But I think maybe the unifying theme more than any other is many of the whistleblowers, and I don't know whether this is rationalization after the fact or simply the way they are, but they told me, look, I really didn't have a chance. I would say, after all the horror stories that you've been through, all the difficulties, and, you've almost lost your house, you've lost your marriage, you've lost your health, would you do it again? And they look at me and they say, of course. I have to look at myself in the mirror every morning. Or as one woman put it, I couldn't put my kids to bed every night if I hadn't.
How invested do the attorneys need to be who represent these cases? Because the economic consequences of these whistleblowers and their career is really spiraling downward.
Yes, attorneys have to be very attuned not only to the legal realities of the case, but also to the psychological and personal realities. Really good whistleblower attorneys, immediately when a case comes up, they consult with next of kin. They consult with the group of people that are close to this whistleblower to ensure there's support. Isolation is the worst thing for a whistleblower, being solitude, being alone. That's what the organization immediately tries to create by putting them in a makeshift desk in the cellar by the toilet and humiliating them. But having a support group, including the attorney, is a vital part of keeping them going.
Talking with Tom Mueller, his new book is called Crisis of Conscience, and he interviewed hundreds of whistleblowers. Do you think whistleblowers are in need of more protections? What policies do you think would better protect whistleblowers from retaliation? How do you want to see lawmakers take action? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the history of whistleblowers and their impact on our government and society today. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. President Trump continues to insist that the whistleblower who filed the initial complaint that sparked the House's impeachment inquiry cannot remain anonymous. The status of that whistleblower has been the focus of the 24-hour news cycle.
Well, breaking news in our politics lead, the president continues to mislead and attack the whistleblower.
Today, President Trump is fuming in a series of tweets about the whistleblower.
The whistleblower, whose story helped to set off this impeachment inquiry, is getting some backup. Lawyers for that CIA employee say they now represent, quote, multiple whistleblowers.
What do you think of President Trump's pressure to reveal the identity of the intelligence officer who filed a whistleblower's complaint? Join in at 800-642-1234. Author Tom Mueller stays with us. His new book is called Crisis of Conscience. Tom, as we look at the House's impeachment inquiry, should the whistleblower at the heart of this inquiry be concerned that the president will find a way to expose their identity?
Absolutely. I mean, the president, in spite of all law and regulation that legitimately protects whistleblowers who have come through the proper channels, protects their identity, he is insisting it's some sort of showdown in the OK Corral that he needs to go chest to chest with this person. It's complete nonsense, but it's also completely typical playbook for delegitimizing or attempting to shift the focus of people's attention from the facts that are at issue, the facts that the whistleblower brings forward, to the personality of the whistleblower. And by putting up this smoke screen, you're quite often able to reshift the focus of people's attention to what sort of person are they, what motivations they had, what do they have for breakfast, what's their sexual orientation, and so forth, and really lose in the shuffle the key bits, which are the evidence of wrongdoing, the evidence of a violation of the Constitution that the whistleblower has reported. So this is a standard, you know, whistleblower retaliation 101 that he's pulling. He's just pulling it from the Oval Office, which is a really intimidating thing if you're a public servant, to have the president tweeting and talking about how we used to deal with spies and, you know, talking like a gangster, rub them out. And we know that loyalists of a charismatic leader like Trump sometimes carry out those desires. It's a very scary situation for this person to be in.
Well, let's look at the legal protections. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, you write in your book, hates fraud, hates waste and abuse, and has helped pass more than 30 whistleblower laws. And now he's defending the Ukraine whistleblower at the center of this impeachment inquiry. Why does Senator Grassley believe the rights of whistleblowers should be protected? Where have you seen his movement?
Chuck Grassley has been a historic champion of whistleblowers. He has a common American trait, which is part of the reason why whistleblowing is such a bipartisan topic. He hates fraud, waste, and abuse. He hates people who rip off the government. And he sees, quite rightly, that whistleblowers are the best tool, the best voice for getting the word out about fraud, waste, and abuse. And he's seen it very early on and has been a stalwart champion of people of all descriptions, left, right, and center. So he's actually unique in Congress for 40 years. He's been supporting whistleblowers. But again, it's a pragmatic thing. It works. You know, one law alone, the False Claims Act, since 1986, when Chuck Grassley helped to refound this law, has recovered $60 billion in stolen tax dollars for the Treasury and deterred something like $1 trillion in fraud, where people look around and say, the False Claims Act, anyone in this office could be a whistleblower. Better not do that. I think we'll do something else. So it's an incredibly powerful tool, and Chuck Grassley has seen that all along. And to his credit, after a period of silence when President Trump came out after the whistleblower, Chuck Grassley has said, no, the law and the regulations say this person's anonymity must be maintained.
Is the False Claims Act getting strengthened today, or do you see it vulnerable?
Well, one of the historic enemies of the False Claims Act, William Barr, happens to be the Attorney General. This is not good news for whistleblower advocates. He has other fish to fry right now, but you know in his heart of hearts, he would like to expunge that law or at least cripple it. That has happened in the past. In World War II, defense contractors were able to cripple the law, which had originally been passed under Abraham Lincoln in 1863. So William Barr has pronounced the provisions of the False Claims Act to be unconstitutional. He said they're an abomination. whistleblowers are an abomination. He's clearly a vehement opponent of whistleblowing because, again, he is a champion of the imperial presidency. He is a champion of the superpowered executive branch, and he sees whistleblowers, private citizens, doing a public-private partnership to enforce the laws as an infringement upon executive executive power. This seems like a complete nonsense to me. We're looking at something that is one of the most effective fraud-fighting tool that the Department of Justice has at its disposal. And most line attorneys now know this after having made their own careers on False Claims Act cases. But it is a time, very worrisome time for whistleblowers and for whistleblower law. It's also true that on the public side, that's corporate law.
Mm-hmm.
On the public side, we have been passed in the fast lane by the European Union. For the longest time, we were the only country to have whistleblower provisions for public servants. Then the UK came in 1998. Now there are over 70 countries that have good whistleblower laws of one sort or another. And the EU has just passed a law that's significantly stronger and with better protections than what we have in the United States, with key provisions that we've been fighting for 40 years. They got it done in 2 to 3 years. So we're no longer the pioneers. We were historically the first country to really pass these laws, and all laws, including the European directive, are rooted in American law and in American lessons. But we need to up our game to catch up with the European Union.
Talking with Tom Mueller, who reports on fraud and corruption, and his latest book is about whistleblowers. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, take us to the first whistleblower you introduce us to, Alan Jones. He is an investigator with the Pennsylvania state government. Tell us about his case, what he finds as an investigator there in Pennsylvania.
Alan Jones was an investigator at the Inspector General's office in Pennsylvania. And his job was to investigate. And he discovered that the state pharmacist was taking checks and depositing them in an unnamed account, which was a felony offense in Pennsylvania. And he started to try to get, as he said, as an investigator, I look for the big picture. I look for why this is happening. Well, those checks are being written by major pharmaceutical companies, including Johnson & Johnson. And he started to question the pharmaceutical executives about what they were doing. And he discovered a massive 20-state, multi-billion-dollar fraud scheme in which the pharmaceutical companies were essentially corrupting state officials in order to make sure that their very powerful antipsychotic drugs were being used as the first treatment of choice for a wide range of illnesses, most of which had not been cleared by the FDA. So not only was it dangerous because this drug, in particular Risperdal, a drug for which Johnson & Johnson has paid billion-dollar fines since, these drugs were also vastly more expensive. So it was doing human harm to patients, and it was also costing Medicare and Medicaid in these states billions of dollars. Now, the ironic thing is Alan Jones was doing his duty in the Inspector General's office. He's an inspector. The problem is he got clamped down on not only by the pharmaceutical companies who disliked his prying, but by his own office, whose higher-ups felt pressured, political pressure. One of his colleagues said, listen, back off on this. These people, meaning the pharmaceutical people, pay checks to both sides of the aisle. So there was a huge attempt to squelch Alan Jones's case, to shred his documents. And he had to bring suit, a whistleblower suit, against his own office as a state employee under a First Amendment whistleblower law. And then he brought something like a False Claims Act against Johnson & Johnson in the state of Texas, where they have a state law that allows an individual to become a private attorney general and prosecute a case on behalf of the state in this case. And he won. He won $150-odd million settlement from Johnson & Johnson.
He won, but he didn't feel closure in that. And his settlement was reduced.
Correct. Again, the political pressures that caused the reduction of that sentence, of that settlement were shocking to him and to all observers. And the reality is, this is just this money. I mean, the actual sufferers, the victims, as he himself points out, were not redressed at all. They didn't even come up in the discussion. It was how much money was taken from the state. But what about those people who took those drugs, or were given those drugs in hospitals, in reform schools, in prisons? These people are harmed, and Alan Jones knew it. And he still, to this day, feels that he let them down to a certain extent.
Tom Mueller is our guide. His new book is called Crisis of Conscience. Have you seen wrongdoing at your work? How do you respond? How did that affect your life? Why do you think it's hard for people to call out fraud and corruption? And what do you think sets whistleblowers apart? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll continue this look at whistleblowers with Tom Mueller right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Join us this evening at 7 as the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination face each other for their next debate. We'll bring you live coverage of that and analysis from NPR. That's tonight at 7 right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about living in the age of the whistleblower, as author Tom Mueller describes it. His new book is called The Crisis of Conscience, and he writes about how whistleblowers have become really a vital crime-fighting paradigm, as he calls it. A recent study found every dollar spent on building a false claims case recovers $20 stolen dollars from the Treasury. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Your questions about whistleblowers, fraud, or how you have called in your line of work, where you have tried to set the record straight. Tom, let's look at a question here. Mark from Kimberly called in to ask what your opinion is of the Government Accountability Project and this nonprofit whistleblower protection and advocacy organization. How has that helped protect whistleblowing?
The Government Accountability Project is one of the absolute premier champions of whistleblowing, of whistleblowers themselves. They represent them quite often pro bono. And of whistleblower legislation. They're constantly pushing for a better protections, better laws. They're featured in my book, and a number of them, their members, are a central part of the stories I tell. It's incredible to see how much work they do. I've been a fly on the wall or kind of embedded in their offices for weeks at a time, and the number of eye-poppingly important cases that walk through their doors every day. And the amount of work that they can do on a real shoestring is truly incredible. I wish I could have a magic wand and fund them properly, because they're doing critical work for our democracy.
And I'm sure they're seeing a whole bunch of cases come their way. And you mentioned the SEC receives thousands of whistleblower cases each year. Are all of these cases investigated? What happens?
There is a triage process at the beginning, because realistically, you know, there are whistleblowers who have totally valid and urgent complaints. There are whistleblowers who have good faith complaints, but they've misunderstood something. They think that the problem is actually bigger than it is. There are also people who for one reason or another, have a story to tell, but they're not a real whistleblower at all. It's important to understand where people stand in this continuum, and to identify the people who are, you know, who are just not going to be able to succeed in a legal forum and would be better off just kind of easing off and being reassured that everything's all right. Of course, those people don't always do that. But it's the triage process and the decision-making process, how to handle each case, is critical, because resources are limited, and a serious whistleblower case can last for a decade.
Take us to the life of Ernie Fitzgerald, an Air Force worker who blew the whistle on overspending on a fleet of transport planes. How did his experience help craft the laws that determine how whistleblowing works?
Ernie Fitzgerald is a true American hero and an unsung hero. I hope I sing his praises properly in my book, because I met him briefly shortly before he passed at the age of 92. He was in a nursing home in Falls Church outside of D.C. and a wonderful, wonderful man from Birmingham, Alabama, with a wicked, wicked rapier-like wit. But he could play, you know, the country, relaxed gentleman, and put people at ease, even his enemies at ease, until he pulled out the rapier-like wit and skewered them before they really knew what was happening. Ernest Fitzgerald reported a $2 billion cost overrun by Lockheed, which was at that point, and still is, the number one military contractor in America and a central part of the military-industrial complex. Lockheed has a lot of fans in the Pentagon, and Ernie worked in the Pentagon. So when he, as he put it, committed truth by telling Congress that this contract that Lockheed had with the government was grossly overspending and would probably spend even more, he was immediately attacked. Now, this was at a time in 1969 when many whistleblower laws did not exist, and his tenacity and Machiavellian ability to outplay and out-strategize his opponents in the Pentagon and at Lockheed got the attention of people like Chuck Grassley. And they began to champion his work. And his experiences of retaliation and legal creativity helped to found some of the most important whistleblower statutes that we have today.
Well, you, in the military, it can be that you tie your career with a project, with a type of technology. And if that technology is not working or failing, that can be consequential to your own career. Was there that type of thinking going on in some of these whistleblowing cases in the military?
Very definitely. One of the most dramatic cases I tell is that of Franz Geil, who was a civilian advisor to the U.S. Marine Corps. He had been an active duty Marine. He was called over to Iraq to look at the situation of critical supplies, including properly armored vehicles that were not being sent to the Marines. And many, many Marines were being killed in lightly armored Humvees by explosive devices. And his general at the time gave him an order, go back to Washington and fix this, because our boys are dying here, boys and girls. I mean, it was several hundred people had been incinerated needlessly in poorly protected vehicles. So,
and he's seeing these vehicles come back to the base at Fallujah, just, you know, blown out, completely charred.
Exactly. There was an entire junkyard with incinerated vehicles, and it was clear that the problem lay with the technology, with the protections that simply weren't there. So, and he also saw the bodies of the people that came back to the base. So he saw it with his own eyes. He saw the victims firsthand. He went back to Washington, and he made it his mission to make sure that a properly armored vehicle, which already was on the shelf, ready to go, the MRAP, was sent to active fighting in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The problem is that MRAP competed with ongoing other projects, multi-billion-dollar projects by major defense contractors that were being built. And the perception at Quantico, the supply base for the Marines, was, hey, if we send the MRAPs, then these other multi-billion-dollar projects are going to lose focus. They're going to lose funding. Will lose out. And as you said earlier on, Kate, the career of a person in the supply chain, in a defense contractor, is quite often tied up with the success of the projects they work on. So there was an enormous institutional resistance to send the proper equipment, which was there, and to wait and roll out these brand new machines, which of course would take years, and thousands of people would have died in the meantime. Franz Geil was not good with that. He put his career on the line in order to fix that, and suffered severe, severe personal consequences. Heartbreaking to hear the kinds of attacks and accusations and investigations, criminal investigations, and all kinds of other really destabilizing attacks on his personality, on his patriotism, simply because he got life-saving equipment to the front lines. In the end, he was vindicated in the sense that the Secretary of Defense made the MRAPs the first priority, and the MRAPs did arrive, and thousands of lives were saved. But Franz Geil himself, as so often happens in the stories I tell in my book, he led a very, very difficult life for a long time. His life is still complicated by this truth-telling.
We're talking with Tom Mueller. He's a writer who's looked closely at the history of whistleblowers and the threats they face. You can join in. Why do you think it's hard for people to call out perceived fraud and corruption? What do you think sets whistleblowers apart? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Dick now in Middleton. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, good morning. I just have a question. If in your studies, is it legal or have whistleblowers been paid? Like, for example, like CIA maybe planting whistleblowers in an administration to try to get dirt and stuff, or, you know, just to monitor. Is that legal to do? And do you know, does that happen? Because in this case here, I know Adam Schiff has already lied about the whistleblower thing.
An inside informant? Is that what you're...
Yeah, right. Well, okay. Right. I mean, is it possible, is it legal to plant a whistleblower in an organization or administration or a company or anything just to get, you know, dirt on him? And is that legal? And does that happen?
Yeah, Dick,
does he know?
Yeah, thanks for the call. Tom, go ahead.
It's not legal to plant a whistleblower. That means they're not a whistleblower. I think it's a valid question that has been raised by many of my advisors, or several of my advisors who are really up on the military-industrial complex and on Intel in particular. Who is this person and these 12 people, because really we're talking about a community of whistleblowers, are they saying the same things as the Clappers and the Haydens and the Brennans, the spy masters of old, whom Trump has gone out of his way to snub? I think it's just as mistaken to try to focus on the motives that these people might be puppets of the spy masters as it is to say they are spies and traitors and suicide bombers, as one of Trump's supporters said yesterday. You are shifting the focus from the facts to the personality and the motivations of the individual. We're not interested in their motivations, or we should not be. We should be interested in which facts they bring forward. Are those facts good? And we need to test those facts. We don't take their word for it. We need to call witnesses and subpoena documents and find out. But again, focusing on the personality and the motivations of the whistleblower is the typical way in which people lose sight of their critical revelations.
We're talking about the state of government and corporate whistleblowing with Tom Mueller as our guide. His new book is called Crisis of Conscience. Are you a whistleblower? Can you talk about it now? What makes whistleblowers different? Why do they speak out when others won't? Join in with your story about addressing fraud and wrongdoing. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. There's more conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the lives of whistleblowers and instances in government and the private sector. Tom Mueller writes about Democrats and Republicans who can find common ground on fighting fraud. The late Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin was a crusader against government waste, and he had his Golden Fleece Awards that spotlighted what he thought was frivolous use of taxpayer dollars. What lawmakers have you thought helped further efforts in fighting fraud and greed? What whistleblower cases do you wonder about through time? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And Tom Mueller stays with us through the hour. His new book is called Crisis of Conscience, and he interviewed more than 200 whistleblowers for the book. Tom, I was reading an uncorrected copy of the book without an index, and I laughed when I came across Senator Proxmire of Wisconsin, and I kind of threw the book and said, Proxmire made the book. Proxmire is in here. Because we like the Wisconsin connections. What did you see in the late Senator Proxmire?
Well, he was definitely one of those old-fashioned people who believed in a firm handshake and an honest deal, and had a repugnance for waste, fraud, and abuse. And he had the good fortune to meet someone of the nature of Ernie Fitzgerald, who saw it exactly the same way from a very different part of the world, but completely on the same page when it came to ethics, basic ethics. And it sounds so old-fashioned nowadays. One of my whistleblowers, Bill Binney in National Security, said, I think we've forgotten how to be American. But William Proxmire and Ernie Fitzgerald, they knew very well how to be American. And it comes down to a very simple thing. Do the right thing. Don't believe the spin. Don't believe the marketing. Don't go with the flow. If you need to challenge, challenge authority and challenge your group to do the right thing.
You write about Ralph Nader as a progressive attorney, and he's spoken recent days before Harvard Law School students, and he urged them to pursue public service. He said, do you want to be a traditional lawyer who drafts contracts and deeds and represents corporations, or do you want to focus on lawlessness, which is the norm? Help us untangle those words. Why is lawlessness the norm? What is happening to the legal profession?
Well, something that would have been unacceptable for a respectable lawyer to do, someone who would have been an unacceptable client 30 years ago, is perfectly acceptable now. White-collar criminal defense is thriving, and white-collar corporate defense likewise. Unfortunately, the business model of many organizations is simply to push it as far to the line as they can and over the line if necessary, because they know that profits are everything. Short-term gain and quarterly income is really the focus. They use the excuse of shareholder value, these wonderful words. But really, what it is ever more short time scales and ever more focus on money. And that's just going to do, I mean, social science for the last 60 years has told us what that does to people. You can have very, very good people in organizations like that. They're going to be doing bad things most of the time. We are all the children of Stanley Milgram.
Let's take another call now. Nataland in Green Bay. Hi, Nataland.
Hello. I'm a member of the Oneida Tribe and a friend of a whistleblower of Stealing from Our HUD program. And she has reported, and she was blacklisted and suffered greatly. And she got her case in federal court. However, we're supposed to be sovereign, so they don't care what they do within our tribe. They just seems like so many white people benefit from the corruption in our tribe that they don't care what's happening to us.
When you say blacklisted, what do you mean?
The government, the officials. They don't care what's happening to our people and the stealing from our HUD program. They don't care.
Nataland, thank you for the call. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, Nataland, I sympathize a lot because one of the saddest things in my whistleblower stories is almost invariably, even when the whistleblower has been proved to be correct, they never work again. They never work again in that company where they were working. But they are never allowed. They are blackballed in their industry. They never work again in their chosen profession. And there's something really broken, I think, about our society, very two-faced, where we can say, yeah, it's really important to have these whistleblower laws, and they're standing up for a democracy, and we go into the theater and watch these heartwarming whistleblower films. But then we allow, in reality, the real whistleblowers to suffer and die on their own without any work. So I sympathize very much with that blackballing process.
Are we at a really critical point here where we have the laws, we have the free speech, and yet whistleblowers have a really uphill climb in order to seek justice?
We are. We have to remember that a huge amount of positive progress has been made in the last 50 years in terms of the overall opinion, social opinion of whistleblowers. I mean, until the 1960s, really, whistleblower and snitch were almost synonymous. And in some quarters, they still are. But many of us realize that without these insiders with an outsider's conscience, our organizations, which have become more and more secretive, more and more powerful economically and politically, we would not know about the lead-laced water in Flint, Michigan, or about the Panama Papers or the Paradise Papers, or the mortgage fraud of the banks that brought down the economy, or Cambridge Analytica and Facebook corrupting our elections. We wouldn't know any of these things. So we realize the critical importance. Now we need to give it real long-term social meaning by taking on the corporations and the government entities that at this point are able to make the whistleblower's life miserable in the long term by blackballing them. It is simply unacceptable that we can allow whistleblowers to suffer so completely for doing the right thing on our behalf.
What kind of threat right now does intimidation pose to the whistleblower process as we see President Trump tweeting that he deserves to meet his accuser, the whistleblower?
Well, having the commander-in-chief call you a spy, call you a suicide bomber, accuse you of lying, even though he himself has corroborated most of the statements in the whistleblower complaint, that's very intimidating. I mean, for anybody, including and especially a civil servant. But there are lots of ways in which corporations and the government itself can intimidate and silence whistleblowers. There are interminable lawsuits. There are criminal investigations. There are psychiatric fitness for duty examinations. There's physical and mental abuse. Lots and lots of stories that I've told in my book that are really, really moving and disturbing. It's hard to imagine a situation in which we can see someone clearly is right, and yet we allow this to happen on a daily basis.
I was taken by the attorneys who have taken in whistleblowers who literally have lost everything. They've lost their lives. They have no money left. The Alan Davises of the world who have now no indoor plumbing and live out of a cabin. Is there a path forward for them not to lose everything? Where do you see hope?
Well, I do see enormous amount of hope in the fact that one individual armed with the truth, can take on a multinational corporation with billions of dollars in market cap, can take on an entire government agency or the president of the United States and hold their own. That is a strong message of individual conscience and the power of the truth. Having said that, we really do need to get serious about whistleblower protections, and we cannot be good with simply anti-retaliation laws that have no teeth, reinstatement of government employees, but in reinstatement in a workplace that's a nightmare. We need to get serious about long-term protection and long-term punishment, frankly, for the people that these whistleblowers call out. Because if they're allowed to set the nature of the debate and allowed to call the long-term shots, those whistleblowers will continue to suffer.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Tom Mueller is a journalist who reports on fraud and corruption. He's the author of the new book, Crisis of Conscience, Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud. Tom will be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival this Friday at 7:30 in the evening at the Central Library in downtown Madison. Just ahead, a new bill will provide state funding to move coal piles away from the Green Bay downtown riverfront. We'll talk with an elected official who joins us to explain what's at stake. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.